Welcome back to Makerspace, a podcast by Christian Education National, a network of Christian schools across Australia. I'm Sam, and in this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Lynn Swanner. Lynn is the president of CARDIS, a North American think tank dedicated to strengthening institutions for the common good. She's the editor or lead author of several influential books, including Future Ready, Mind Shift, and Flourishing Together. With a doctorate in organizational leadership, Lynn is also a good friend of CEN and has spoken at a number of our conferences over the years. In our conversation, we explore a wide range of topics, from a Christian vision of flourishing to innovation and the role of research in schools. We also talk about what makes a Christian school truly distinctive, and Lynn shares a powerful question that helps schools stay on mission. What does love require? Here's Lynn. I'm very lucky to be sitting here with Lynn Swanner and to basically get into her brain a little bit. What's nice about your perspective, Lynn, is that you're a researcher, and I wondered if you could just give a little bit of an overview about what you've been doing the last few years and the books you've been involved in, the conferences you've been involved in, the kind of work you're really interested in doing going forward, if that's okay.
Sure. Thanks so much, Sam, for having me. And it's been a tremendous blessing to be able to work with Christian schools and educators and people from all different educational sectors over the last few years. So just by way of a quick background, by training, I'm an academic. I am a researcher, as you mentioned. And so I used to be at the university level. And when my children went to Christian school, I essentially followed them. I was on sabbatical. And so I volunteered in the school and just immediately fell in love with it. I fell in love with being at the primary and secondary levels, and I fell in love with being at a faith-based school and the kind of holistic integration that that allowed for. So I essentially transferred a lot of the skills, if you will, and the foci that I had when I was in the tertiary space in terms of a really deep interest in flourishing and holistic outcomes, not only for students, but also for educators, for families, for adults, for communities, and also a lot of the research methods that I used. So really looking at broader research projects that bring in various stakeholders that are longitudinal, that incorporate practitioners. And so I brought that, if you will, into the Christian school space. And so I volunteered in that school, and then that quickly turned to a full-time leadership position, and then ended up working in a very large Christian School Association, mostly based in the U.S., but with a significant global presence. And then was a CARDIS senior fellow for a few years, and then joined CARDIS full-time in January of 24. So that role is sort of the culmination of a lot of different experiences and enables me to do research now on much more of a global and international scale, although I did do quite a bit of that. So sort of that career journey, if you will, where that has taken me is questions about what are schools for? What is education for? How do we flourish together? How do we look for holistic outcomes? How do we craft school cultures and environments where people can grow and learn together? And that doesn't mean that things are always going beautifully or wonderfully. That means through the challenge and through the difficulty, how do we live together in community? So that has led to quite a number of projects. Of course, the Flourishing Schools research that culminated in Flourishing Together book was one of them, but also some of the work with Future Ready, which looked at innovative missions and models in Christian schools, really to say the educational system and approaches that we've kind of inherited as we move into this century are kind of built for a different century. And not only that, in some ways, they don't really lead to those types of flourishing outcomes that we would like. So where are there schools that are doing innovative things that really are aligned very tightly with their missions, but they're reimagining what that looks like for their school? So actually, how can they be more faithful to their mission as they begin to interrogate, question, and reformulate the way that they do things, whether it's pedagogy, whether it's structures in their schools, or how they relate to the community, et cetera, et cetera. And then I would sort of say the last major area that I've been working with, which I did a little bit when I was a fellow for Cardis, but now I'm fully heading up, is our Cardis Education Survey. And so that's been done 4 times in the US, 3 in Canada, once in Australia, hoping to sort of reboot that in Australia as well, but really looking at, again, holistic outcomes, but in different school sectors. And the goal of that is not to say one sector is better than another, or here's, it really is to make the argument that there's evidence of flourishing across various outcomes in each of these sectors. And that really supports the notion that educational pluralism is good for society. It's good for students, it's good for educators, it's good for families, it's good for society. So it's sort of a full circle, if you will. I've been really, really blessed to be able to do the things that I love, which is that nexus of asking really good questions, answering them rigorously through research, connecting with practitioners and helping to shape practice and sort of that virtuous cycle, if you will.
Very interesting. Well, you've touched on a lot of things I want to go back to, like innovation and flourishing, all that kind of stuff. But one of my first questions would be, what's important about research? Because my hunch is that a lot of schools, a lot of Christian schools, can sort of exist on very strong convictions or very strong anecdotal ideas about what could go on or what should go on or what does happen. But research is actually the uncovering of what does go on and what does work. So, what would you say to people who maybe have a suspicion of academia or maybe find it a little bit superfluous? What would you say to them about the sort of the place of research and what we do and what it says and what it provides for us?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I might end up waxing long on this as well, because I'm quite passionate about it. But I would start in quite a theological place, if that's okay to start there, which is that if we think about the nature of knowledge and understanding, it's really a fascinating thing to think about. So you have sort of a creation that we can sort of see, this general revelation. We can understand the nature of what it means to be created. We can understand that there's sort of a glorious design. We see handiwork that, couldn't possibly have just spontaneously, happened. So we use our faculties, our eyes, our ears, we use whatever we have to understand, explore. And so we are knowing beings in that sense. We're meant to engage with our environment. We do that in outside in nature, in our homes, et cetera. And then there's also what you might call special revelation. So, for those who are Christians, have the word of God, and that's revealed in certain lots of study, et cetera. So I think we already, if you're a person of faith, pretty much most faiths, but certainly your kind of traditional Judeo-Christian faiths, or the people of the book, you have sort of this general understanding revealed through creation, and you also have very specific texts and specific words that you can access. And that's to say nothing of how we're actually designed. Like, it's actually fascinating to think about. We could spend a lot of time here, just neuropsychology and neurobiology of how we actually take in information and learn and synthesize. But there's a highly relational component. If you have, this is really going down a rabbit hole, but when you look at how children learn language, it really is in that interplay, in a baby or a toddler with an adult, and it's a constant interplay. So there's this relational piece to knowing. So I say all that to say that sort of fabric of reality, that sort of general understanding, very specific understanding that's pertinent to that context, and then also that relational dynamic, that translates pretty much into any field that you can think of. It's just sort of how we are, how the world is set up, how the universe is set up. And so when we get into a school, there's sort of the sense of, okay, well, we sort of know and appreciate and understand what it means to educate, what it means to be in an educational community, and what we're after. And then there's very specific, this is our mission, this is our vision, these are the things that we believe we're called to do, and that's going to motivate and activate us, right? And then there is also the relational component. You can have the perfect mission and vision, and you could have, really good understanding of how things ought to work in schools, but relationally things are falling apart at the seams. And so where research kind of comes in there, and we make it more complicated than it needs to be, research is one of the gifts that I think we've been given to ask questions and then to try and seek answers that can then inform practice. And one of the really interesting things, I love the book. It's called Jesus is the Question. And it's called the 508 questions that, or sorry, the 308 questions that Jesus answered, and like the very few that he asked, and like the three that he answered. So, we see Jesus as in the scriptures as asking tons of questions. And did he need to know those? He didn't need to know the answers to that, but there's a lot of reasons for that. And questions are one of the most powerful tools we have as human beings for learning, for growth, for understanding. So research enables us to ask questions, to explore that methodically, and then to help that to inform our practice. So I think it's not so much an issue of like, hey, you're kind of missing out if you're not looking at research or if you're not asking good questions in your own setting. It doesn't have to be an academic that's doing it. I mean, school, action research, there's lots of different ways that leaders and educators should do work in their own space here. But actually, I think it's cutting off a really significant way we're designed to know and explore and steward creation and create culture, et cetera.
Very interesting. And when I mean, you've talked about the nature of knowledge, which I find very interesting, but I'll try and avoid going down that rabbit hole myself just because I'm interested. But talking about your story and you getting into Christian education via your research background, were there questions you felt like weren't being explored particularly when you first started? Did you sense, for lack of a better term, a bit of a gap in the market in any sense?
Yeah, I think there were probably a few, and I think part of it was likely because the research that I was doing in the tertiary space and the university space was kind of at the time quite cutting edge. It was interdisciplinary. It had space for faith and for moral and character formation. So this would have been the early aughts. So that was pretty. Now that's much more accepted, and you can find whole centers on human flourishing at multiple universities, right? And so that was not the case in the early aughts. And I would say when I walked into the Christian education space and probably the late aughts into early 2010, I would say that I found the space very much to be what I had encountered in the tertiary and the university space, which is sort of at the end of how far questions around efficacy could get us, at the end of the school improvement paradigm, which was very helpful in a lot of ways, but not, it doesn't help to be always improving and ticking all these boxes on these very narrow measures of academic attainment. And so when I came into the Christian school space, I found it to be a really great space where there was very good articulation of values and of mission and of knowing who we are, and then also a disconnect from a lot of practices. And I'm not the only one, I think, who would say that. For example, David Smith on Christian teaching came out within the first few years that I was in the Christian school space. And it was one of the really first times anybody had ask the question, how are our faith actually to inform our pedagogy? We're quite good on how it should inform our curriculum, right? We're having the curriculum wars and still having the curriculum wars on that. Do you use this type of textbook or that textbook? Or do you do this? What do you do? And David really asked deeper questions around integrating faith and learning in our pedagogy. And I think I came in at about the same time when it was how do we actually measure what it is that we do up against what who we say we are. And I think that is really where a lot of the generative work has been done. Because if we do view people as created in the image of God, right? If we do view Ephesians 2:10 as true, that he's created them for good works, right? That he's ordained for them to do well in advance, then we can't settle for very small measures of academic outcomes. Those are important, but we have to ask, we can't just teach to a test. We can't just focus on very discrete packets of information and memorizing them so that then students don't know what to do with it when they graduate and they say that was an entire waste of time, right? We're not being true to who we say we are and how we believe people to be created to learn. So when you talk about things like flourishing outcomes, so looking at outcomes, when you talk about things like being creative and innovative in the work that we do to reach our missions and our goals, which don't change, all of those things were some of the gap. I think we had really inherited, and again, I said this earlier, not question the kind of dominant mo modes of education that we inherited from the 1900s. And I think that has been something that has changed rapidly because people are asking really good questions and looking for answers.
So as I'm listening to you, the language you're using and the clarity that you come at this stuff with is you're definitely an academic, which is it's really nice to listen to. But it does make me wonder, and perhaps this is a bit more of a personal question based on your experience. But when you go to certain conferences, particularly educational conferences, and you're speaking to sometimes thousands of people, I can imagine sometimes they're not looking for the academic approach. And I just wonder, have there been moments where you've gone to present and people are like, oh, well, this isn't quite what we were expecting from you? Have you experienced any sort of friction between what you're actually there to say and what people are wanting to hear?
I would say probably earlier on in my career, I think in those early aughts, and that was probably, to be fair, a combination of both where the field was at, sort of there was more distrust of academic research. I've seen that change over the years where people say, well, actually, we can look at research when we don't, we can question its assumptions. We can do our own research from our own perspective. So I think that's changed and probably a little bit of naivete and growth needed on my part in the early aughts. I always think to myself, even when I was a school leader, I look back and think, wow, I would do things really, really differently. I guess that's just a function of time and age, and maturity. But I think, what I try and do when I speak is essentially, even if it's to a few thousand people, which I've had the honor and the privilege to do, is to envision myself back in my university teaching. So I was very, very blessed. So when I say I taught university, I taught at the master's level, at the graduate level in the States. So these were all, I would say, over 24 years old, many of them actually middle age, so in their 40s, early 50s, so career changers or parents returning to the workforce after being home with kids. And the one thing that I will tell you that graduate students absolutely cannot abide is wasting their time. And so I would work with good reason. I mean, they're there for a specific goal, often a career goal. They want things that they're learning to connect. And also, if you look at andragogy, which is adult pedagogy, that's why it's andra. And there, you have to incorporate experience and reflection. That's how adults learn. And so I think that really helped to shape me to be able to say, here are kind of the major points that we want to make, to use examples, to share, to use rich language, and really to kind of get to the point of what people need to know. So I love using. One of my favorite things to do when I present data is using really we at Cardis we call it. Sensational facts, understated prose. So, I'll give you one example, and I'll just kind of we'll stop there on this line of thought. But one of the things that came out of the Flourishing Schools research, which now I present on this in so many different countries to thousands of different educators, but one of the most sort of shocking things was that we found was that in a school where the leaders are really engaged with their external community. So there's this sort of community and school, doesn't have to be formal, but just partnerships and relationships. That when their alumni are asked, are you continuing to walk with God? They're more as twice as likely to say yes. And that is alum, those are alumni who may be of no faith background, of any faith. It doesn't matter. And that is a very, very provocative data point, because from there, then I can work with an audience and say, why do you think that is, et cetera.
Awesome. Oh, that's really cool. Well, there's a few words that have come up as we've spoken already. One of them is obviously flourishing. I think what's interesting is that there's a few key words that keep coming up in education as people have begun to ask big questions about, what is distinctive about Christian education. And it's one of those words that can be quite vague because people can sometimes attach themselves to certain classical education models and say that's flourishing, or they can do things that look a little bit more like critical pedagogy and say this is what it really means for a student to flourish. But I imagine you mean something pretty specific when you relate it to Christian schools and you're thinking theologically. So, to avoid falling into, I guess, very broad categories of flourishing that we might use, what do we mean by flourishing when we have these conversations?
No, it's a great question. So, and I would think that when I unpack this, hopefully this will make sense and a number of different pedagogical models can fit very easily under here. So when we talk about flourishing, it actually is a biblical concept. So it appears 33 times across 12 translations of the Bible. And it comes from a very agrarian time, obviously. So biblical times were much more agrarian writ large. Obviously, we have agrarian communities today, but that would have been the dominant way of understanding the world. And so it really means things like to bud, to grow, to bloom. There's an intergenerational component of, so Psalm 115, 114, verse 14, there's this blessing. May you and your children, may God cause you to flourish. So there's even an intergenerational piece where it's not just the kids, but it's also the adults within the community. And so realistically, when we talk about it within the context of Christian education, we're talking about people being able to live into the fullness of who God has created them to be and to be able to live out the designs, the good works, as I mentioned in Ephesians 2:10, that he has for them. And so if you really believe that, and that's the goal. And again, that doesn't mean bad things aren't going to happen. I mean, you live on this planet for 2 minutes and you know that there will be challenges and difficulties that all of us will encounter. But if you really believe that, then you start asking the question, what does an education for that type of flourishing look like? And Christian schools have a bit of a leg up on that because they sort of already have that theological understanding. And again, where the disconnect often is in the methods that they're using to teach, to train, to provide opportunities. I mean, if we really believe that, then do we give students the opportunity to do real work with real people? Are we sort of locking them in a classroom? So there's a lot of implications for that. I certainly have had the experience of being with different types of pedagogical models and people who are particular, even to governance structures, it's sort of very convinced that this is really the one model. And I would say flourishing doesn't mean that there isn't one model that you're called to or one approach that you could use as a teacher. And so I think there are different ways. For me, flourishing is more about the alignment of what we say we want to do and then how we are actually doing it. But I've seen, and that's part of our research, even at Cardis, is to be really agnostic is not the right word, but to really say, okay, we're not even going to do the deep dive per se into what it means to be within the sector, Protestant schools. You can have a classical school or have these different pieces. That doesn't mean we don't want to look at it. We certainly do, particularly as sectors diversify. But realistically, we're looking for those holistic outcomes wherever they're found.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, so again, another one of those words that have started to come up again and again in our conversation so far is this word distinctive, which is very, very important. And the book that you were involved in a couple of years ago, Future Proof, starts to really tackle that, and it's very cognizant of a lot of things that are changing in our world, whether it be technology or different attitudes. And so there's a sense in which we do have to continue to ask the question. And I think sometimes you can feel as if people, like we had this answer years ago. We know what it means to be at a distinctive school. But I think with culture continually changing, I mean, even this year, I feel like things have changed quite quickly with attitudes and displays of power that we haven't seen for a little while. And that does mean that the way that a Christian school is positioned does need to keep responding to those things, that it needs to show that it's distinct as things continue to change. So I guess I guess to open it up to you to answer in any way that you would like, at this point, what would you say are some of the really important things to be aware of about what it means for us to be distinctive and not necessarily looking like a classical model or conservative or things like that? What is Christian about a Christian school when it comes to pedagogy and things like community development and culture and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent question, and I really would recommend sort of the thrust of a very large conference that we just did, the Converge Conference, which was coming together for of 11 different associations around the world. And it was quite an interesting moment, given our geopolitical kind of situation, to have people from so many different parts of the world together and really worshiping together and coming from some very different perspectives, even to be able to come together around the question of what is Christian education, what are our distinctives, and can we actually articulate any of them given the current moment that we have. And so the theme for that conference, which I think matches quite well to your question, was faithfully present and courageously good. And I think that is what needs to be distinctive about Christian schools writ large. And faithful presence is really pointing back to James Davison Hunter's work, To Change the World, which I think came out in 2010, but really talking about how the church can be faithfully present within the larger culture. And that is through things like he talks about imitating our Creator and Redeemer, pursuing one another, sacrificial love, directing our lives to the flourishing of others. And so that really means sort of avoiding some of those alternatives to culture, which is like creating Christian bubbles or pursuing relevance to the culture to the point that you can't distinguish yourself from it, whatever it might be, or becoming defensive against the culture. And that oftentimes can result in things like political aggression or violence. And Hunter really points out that there are so many Christian institutions over the millennia. So whether patronage of the arts, establishing schools and university, hospitals and things like that, institutions themselves, schools can practice faithful presence. And so I think a Christian school that's shooting to do that, that's aiming to do that, would say, what does it mean to be faithfully present in our community? How do we help our students to be winsome ambassadors and culture shapers? How do we help students to be faithfully present now, not just in the future, but right now, because they are in families, they are in communities, and they're being shaped and formed. And then the second part is, not only thinking about being faithfully present, but also courageously good, because you can be present and not be good. That's kind of the second part of the, you can be very, very present, but that faithfulness then actually has a telos, like what actually comes out of that. And I think there's, we start talking about non-anxious presence. How are we non-anxious within a very anxious kind of world? How do we use that courage that we read about in Joshua 1:9, where God says, don't be anxious, do not be terrified, I'm with you wherever you go. Well, where do we go? What do we do? And so I really take encouragement, Sam, from Romans 12, which really points out some very concrete ways to be good, to be courageously good. So, things like hospitality, right? Things like caring for one another, blessing those who oppose us, living in harmony with others, associating with those of low status, doing right in the eyes of everyone, as much as dependent upon us, living at peace with all men. Paul summons up that entire passage with, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And I think we are living in an evil time. I don't know if there's ever been a time that you couldn't say that. I don't know that our age is particularly more evil than others, to be really honest with you. That's debatable. But yet these scriptures still apply. So, that's just, how do we not turn inward anxiously? How can we look for really pressing needs in our communities and cultures, and we can act redemptively in those areas, right? And then helping students to understand how they can be those winsome ambassadors. So I don't know that any of that actually changes over time. My sense is if we went back 200 years, those questions would probably still be applicable. But I think they are very pressing for our time.
So yeah, there are ways of sort of being aware of the conversation that's going on and not sort of buying into certain things that might be present. You mentioned, James Davison Hunter's work, and mentioned that, we don't want to fall into the trap of being relevant, which is one of his dispositions that he critiques. But in your book, Future Proof, you do say that part of being future proof is a certain degree of relevance. So you do use it differently in that book. So if I could just make that distinction a little bit, you're saying we need a particular type of relevance to be engaging properly. So what do you guys mean by that in the book?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think relevance of the type that we wouldn't want to do would be essentially trying to prove that we are the same, or cozying up to, or trying to sort of, for lack of a better term, virtue signal like we're, hey, we're with you kind of thing. Or being indistinguishable to the point that you could walk into a Christian school and look exactly the same as the school down the block, whatever that might be. The relevance we talk about in Future Ready is relevance for real needs. For the community and the education that you're offering, so that you're actually helping students to, again, that feed, keep going back to Ephesians 2:10, that they are prepared for those good works, that the education that they're receiving is relevant to the lives that they will lead. And so that's a little bit different from like relevant. So you can be relevant to the culture in the sense that you're fully identified with, and people are like, hey, that's relevant. That's, whatever term you want to use from whatever generation. Hip, cool, man. I don't even know what the Gen Zers would say. Cooked, I think they say. That's or cooking, one of the two. I don't know. I have a grade 9 student. She uses all kinds
Let
of
him
words that I
cook,
don't
Queen.
understand.
Let him cook.
Let them cook. Yeah, like there's all of that, right? That's one type of relevance, but then there's another type where it's saying, okay, our society, our community, our neighborhood has a real need, particularly that not many people are paying attention to, and this school is meeting that need. This school is actually being relevant to this community in the sense that they're serving, they're loving. And as we train students to do that, wherever they find themselves in whatever status, whatever role, whatever career, if they have that service-minded, that loving their neighbor mindedness, they will always be the salt and the light, right? And they will always be doing the countercultural thing. Because I truly, again, this is looking back over history. Maybe there has been, but I don't think there's been a culture. A time where every culture in the world was fully focused on loving your neighbor as yourself, right? I just don't. That stands out in any society in any time, and that is the faithfully present and courageously good that we're called to be.
So it's, there's definitely an element in what you're saying. We need to be listening well in order to do that, and deeply involved and growing alongside our communities to do that properly. Within this book, Future Ready, there's an emphasis on innovation, which hasn't historically been something that's been at the heart of some Christian schooling. You can often, I mean, this is a massive generalization, but you can often get the sense, and there's good thinking behind this, is where we need to hold on to the things that matter as culture shifts, as the world changes. We've got things to hold on to. And that's deeply important to what it means to be a Christian, actually. We are constantly bringing the important parts of the past into the present and not leaving those behind, especially the gospel, right? So, we don't want to say that that was the wrong disposition. I think, though, sometimes that can come at the cost of not asking the question around why innovation is important. And I think this sort of comes back to how we understand hope and God continuing to do things and not having just acted in the past. So you talk about this, an important part that we need to really consider innovation, and asking questions like, why aren't Christian schools at the forefront of pedagogy and technology use? So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that and maybe offer a little bit of encouragement about why this could be important in an age of AI and high technology use and things like that. Why actually devoting a little bit of time and energy to that is a very good thing.
Yeah, I think that I would say, I think that absolutely education is slow to change as a sector, and that's probably a good thing. Because as you're saying, particularly in Christian institutions, it's not it's not good for us to sort of be throwing out things and switching constantly and trying different things. There's also quite a different motive. I mean, I've spent time with people who are working for the big tech firms, and they're motivated by a different set of things that are compelling them to do what they do, and that shapes how they see the world and how they put things out into the world. So I agree with you that I don't think it's a bad thing at all that schools tend to be a little bit slower to adopt and more considerate. My concern has always been, and I mentioned this before, is what is our mission and how do we actually live into that mission in today? So a really like sort of one-dimensional example that I think will resonate with people is if you look at how people read the Bible, 300 years ago or even 600 or 700 years ago, like if we go pre-Gutenberg press to, the last few hundred years, and now most people are accessing a lot of people are accessing the Bible via an app on their phone, right? So that's the same truth, but significant innovations. I mean, it's really funny. People a lot of times don't realize that an organ in a church was a massive innovation. Just massive. Like just having, so these are the kinds of things. And now, we can get worked up about guitars and drums and the rest of it. Does that, and do those things change our experience? Absolutely. Do they change our worship and our literature? Yes, they absolutely do. They are innovations. The question is, are they aligned with our mission, and do they actually help us to live further into them? So we recently put out a monograph on art called Navigating AI for Christian Schools. Actually, it's the research that underlies it, but then also a monograph exactly on this question. And really where we start is you've got to start with your mission. You've got to start with your educational philosophy as an institution. Recognize that really there's not, even though AI is obviously very shocking in some ways, mostly due to its conversational powers and things like that. We've navigated technological change before. I'm old enough to have lived through quite a lot of that. And this is not the time to throw away the compass and the map. It's more to say, okay, how have we leaned into our mission? How can we do that here? And to your earlier question, for some schools, that will mean that they're not going to have devices, or they're not going to have AI. And for other schools, that might mean they're going to go full bore and lean into it. And all of those are good options, if and only if they are well thought out. How do we live out our mission, vision, and values? How does our pedagogy, how do our instructional design and our technological decisions align with that? The last thing I would say is just I have seen a massive shift over the last, I would say since COVID even, that more and more when I visit schools, they tend to be much more innovative in what they're doing in the Christian school sector. So, for example, when I visited schools before COVID, which would have been when we were starting to work on Future Ready, there were schools that I would literally hear say, online instruction is not biblical. And then shortly that, everybody is doing online instruction. So I think our mental models of what education means have been shaken a little bit because we were tested through COVID. And I am seeing in general, I'm pleased to say I'm seeing innovation not everywhere, but I'm seeing much more of an innovative attitude and mindset since. And that's just my personal experience, and certainly not every school, but for many of the schools that I visited in many countries.
Oh, that's so funny. I mean, it reminds me of a parent consultation meeting that I was involved in at a certain school who were building a new primary or elementary school, and they were talking about doing big barn style, so open plan classrooms and all that kind of stuff. And the argument was that open plan classrooms weren't biblical. And you're just thinking, what's more open plan than sitting on the side of a hill giving a sermon? I don't understand. So anyway, it's very interesting what people sit with. I just want to draw attention to something that you have said a few times. So you've used this in talks that you've given, and it pops up in the Flourishing Together book. But you have this question that you draw people back to when you're talking about the mission of Christian schools, and it's this question: what does love require? And I think it's a really good anchoring question, and it's quite a demanding question for a Christian educator. What do you mean by this question, and why is it such a good and important one for us to have sort of in our front of mind?
Yeah, it's a Great. I'm so excited that you mentioned this. So this actually comes directly from a story that we tell in Flourishing Together. And it is one of those stories where we get out of the academics, we get out of the research, we get out of the whole thing, and we actually see a compelling story in action that awakens people's imagination. And consistently, wherever I am and talking about Flourishing Together, people will cite this story. And that's where the what does love require? So I visited a school back in 2018. It's called Halton Hills Christian School. It's right outside of Toronto. It is a small K-8 school. It is not a hugely impressive building in any way, shape, or form. But what they did in the year that I had visited is they actually, for their professional development, had decided they were going to ask of everything that they did, whether it was a professional development decision or an interaction with a parent or a curricular choice, everything, student discipline, what does love require? And they disciplined themselves to do that for a full year, and it radically transformed their practice, but also who they were in terms of their identity as a school. And this is one of those examples where a simple practice actually can be very transformative. So you could go through this sort of, like mammoth curricular review cycle and not have the same impact that that simple question they asked. And they took that actually from Bob Goff's, he authored a book called Love Everybody Always or something of that title. And it was really transformative. And their students began asking it. I actually just did a follow-up call with the school. They've since had a leader who has very intentional succession planning process. So I spoke with the new leader, and it's alive and well, and they are going even deeper into it, if you can imagine. And so I use that an example in the book of, again, the power of questions, right? That questions oftentimes can be very powerful for our learning, even more so than answers. And they also can adapt to context, right? So that question you can use of almost anything. But if you give someone a manual for how to run a school, the minute you give it to them, it's going to change, right? And something's going to be different. So it's very, very powerful. I would commend that story to anyone who's interested in actually learning about it or reading more. But it was something that was really transformative for me as well. And to be able to tell that story kind of around the world, it's not my story. It's that school story has been really impactful.
Brilliant. Okay, a couple of questions to finish with. First question, what have you read recently that you would recommend to Christian educators or anyone really, that you have found really helpful?
Yeah, there's been a couple of books lately. I would recommend two. Andrew Peterson, who's a singer-songwriter, wrote a book called God of the Garden. I'm not sure it's exactly brand new, but it's a beautiful story about God's ecology, economy, the nature and pace of how God has designed the world is quite different to what I think our modern pace is. So that has been really helpful and inspirational and trying to sit with that really well. And another book that I've recently read is On a Theology of Work by Matthew Kamak, who's actually out of Fuller. And that book has been really interesting for me. So I don't come from a liturgical background. I've come to that as a liturgy as an adult. And so really taking a look at the nature of work. So that they use this example in the book of, or they talk about how throughout biblical history and throughout the Bible, people would sort of present their work to God, whether it was through a sacrifice or through a feast day or something like that. And I think a lot of times we look at work, and the book makes this point. We look at work as how can we be a Christian in work? It's by being ethical. It's by being excellent, right? It's by doing these things as opposed to, well, actually taking that a perspective of how is work an opportunity to participate in creation? How's work a way to participate in redemption? And so it's just helping me to go a bit deeper. Because I think that certainly work life, I don't like the word balance, work life integration is a huge issue in education, and in many fields. And this sort of helps us to realize actually it's probably not just a barrier boundary kind of issue. It's probably really a mindset issue of that maybe we've had a bit of a secular sacred divide We've put divides in places that maybe they ought not to exist. And so we're feeling the abrasiveness as we jump up against that boundary, which is not to say you don't need time to unplug. That's not what I'm saying. But just sort of that mindset of not being fully present to one or the other or seeing things as bifurcated. So that's been really a great book for me to be able to look into. And I think it's called Work and Worship.
Awesome. We actually just spoke to Matthew as well. So,
Oh, wonderful. Yeah,
last
he's
October,
fabulous.
he's onto it. He's good. One final question. You've become quite a good friend of Australia over the last few years, and you've got a nice perspective where you get to see quite a lot of the world. I have one, I guess, just a personal question is, what do you notice about the differences between some of our countries? Because it can seem sometimes that we're quite similar in a lot of ways we are in the West. But like quite distinctively different, even me noticing the differences between New Zealand and Australia are quite massive. So what are you noticing the difference between like the States and Australia and places like that you find quite interesting and might take us to slightly different places within Christian education?
I think that's a great question. I probably would need quite a lot of time to prepare an answer to that. I can say some of the things that I've appreciated, maybe as I've spent time with educators from Australia and New Zealand, and some of the things I've appreciated in visiting their schools. And of course, these are going to be real overarching generalizations. And also keeping
Totally.
in mind, Sam, this is really important for you to know, when I go to countries, people generally will take me to schools that they want me to see. So I don't mean to say all schools are like this, but I am recognized that I'm very privileged to really interface with a lot of educators who are doing some incredible work, and they may or may not be well resourced, et cetera, or in a place that's accessible. So I don't want to use a really broad paintbrush, but I think a few of the things that have struck me, and this is going to sound really kind of, I don't want to say shallow, but I've just had a lot of fun with Australian colleagues and with friends, with Kiwis as well. I mean, just a real sense of joy in the work, and I don't think that means an absence of trouble or an absence of difficulty. I'm not saying things are easier, but just a real sense of joy and a sense of a good humor. I mean, I'm from New York, and so sometimes when I go to different parts of the states, I could be a bit much for people, and I've never felt that way in Australia and New Zealand. So there's just sort of that sense of a sense of joy, a sense of being present in the moment. Again, I know that's an overarching generalization, but I think that tends to lend itself to some of the creativity that I've seen as well. So I've seen some very creative schools. I've seen something that is really, I don't know that if you all really realize this, that's unique, is just the incorporation of the landscape oftentimes, or the outdoor play. I've been to whole schools that have in Australia that have been designed around the topography of the land on which they're situated. There's some wonderful connections, and I'm sure a desire to make more connections with Indigenous peoples in the areas that you're in, and to sort of learn from centuries of working and living with the land. And again, all, there's challenges and difficulties with everything that I just have articulated, but I think it's very, very useful, and I wish that there are more educators from North America who could make the trip. It's an arduous trip, as you well know, having probably done it multiple times the other way, but it's just really refreshing to me when I'm able to come, and that's why I'm willing to sort of jump on the plane and go, because it's refreshing, not just in terms of the spaces and the types of schools that I could see, but also just the camaraderie. And again, sweeping generalizations, but that has hands down, at least for me, it's not a generalization. That has been my experience.
Awesome. Well, that's a very good answer. I did throw you under the bus with asking for a massive generalization there. So
Yeah, and I just wish it wasn't so far.
I know. Well,
I
to be
really
honest,
do. I'm like, why is it?
I know. Well, to be honest, I'm always amazed seeing you at conferences is that you just have one sleep and boom, you're ready to go. And I'm already living in that time zone and finding it difficult. So I think your capacity, you have a big capacity by the looks of it. So, well, thank you so much for sitting and chatting for the last little while and looking forward to catching you probably at another conference at some point. But just to say, thanks heaps for all the work that you do and for carrying these questions and for for resourcing schools with this thinking. I think what you're contributing is hugely important, and really grateful for that. So thank you for being our friend and for the work that you do.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. It's great to continue the conversation with you.
Cool. Well, thanks, heaps. Thanks for joining. If you're keen to keep learning and accessing more of CEN's resources, why not subscribe to the Christian Teachers Journal, a publication of the National Institute for Christian Education, the postgraduate arm of CEN. Go to CEN's website, which is in the show notes, and under publications, you can take out an annual subscription to CTJ and receive your own copy of the 4 editions. From time to time, you might even find some writing from our podcast guests. See you next time.